Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Roost Podcast. As always, I am Carter Spires, here with my co-host Matthew Bartlett, the founder and managing editor of The Roost, your premier source for Rice sports news and analysis. Thanks to everybody who's been listening to our extended off-season interview series so far. We've been having a lot of fun doing it, gotten a lot of really cool guests on, so we hope y'all are enjoying that. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. Share the show with a friend. You know, anything that helps us get it out there, we'd really appreciate that. Obviously, you can follow the Roost on social media. There's a separate feed for the podcast as well at the Roost Pod. Taking a bit of a different tack this week, our guest is Shahan Jayaraja from Dave Campbell's Texas Football. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Cool. Well, we thought we'd get you on here and just you know, we've been hyper focused on Rice and gotten some former Rice student athletes on. So we thought we'd take a bit of a different track this time and kind of broaden out to the state as a whole and all the college football programs here. And you're definitely the guy to talk to on that. So we're glad you're here.
I'm excited. It's been a while since I've gotten to kind of really get into this and talk statewide. So I'm ready.
All right, we'll start you off with a softball. Are Texas and Texas A&M going to play again before they both make the playoff?
I'm going to say yes, but it's more about the second half of that question. I do think that there's a hunger for it. I do think it's starting to come back. And look, I mean, I think that one of the things that works out best for them is the Sugar Bowl, right? Because, you know, if you finish second in the Big 12 and you finish second or third in the SEC, you could face off in the Sugar Bowl. I think that's probably the most likely way that we're going to get this game back. I mean, again, it seems like both sides are a little hesitant to maybe schedule that game, you know, for various reasons, obviously, for bragging rights, you know, whatever. But I think that there's a non-zero chance that we get Texas versus Texas A&M in the Sugar Bowl. And look, I mean, either could obviously take a step forward, you know, and I think that Texas A&M, I think that Texas A&M actually has a dark horse case to make it this year, to make the playoff. You know, things just line up really well for them schedule-wise, but I don't know. It's a couple of coin flips out there for both of them. I mean,
there's only so long you can sit quietly in the night and stare at your rival's picture while swearing to yourself that you don't think about them before you have to just get out and play the game, you know?
I mean, it's been a while, right? Like the last game that was played was before I was in college, you know, was in 2011. And ultimately, it's just, come on, this game has been that long? Yeah, 2011.
That makes me feel really dated.
You know, and ultimately, look, I just think it's too good a rivalry not to happen, right? Like, I mean, we look at all these other interconference rivalries. Like, imagine if all of a sudden, you know, Clemson and South Carolina stop playing, right? Like, this isn't even a storied rivalry. This is just, you know, a fun interstate matchup. And
do they not have a trophy?
The Clemson to South Carolina, the Palmetto. I think they do. I mean, and that's one of the things.
A&M and South Carolina have a trophy, so therefore it is a rivalry.
Everybody has a trophy, man. But
trophies are overrated. The Iron Bowl one is like literally the lamest thing in all of sports. It's called the James E. Foy ODK Sportsmanship Trophy.
Look, I'm not necessarily a Big Ten football guy, but the thing that I will give them is that they have the best trophies because they've got like the most random trophies imaginable up there.
What is it? I think it's the Penn State Michigan State trophy. I think that's the one. It's called the Land Grant Trophy.
Sure. And
it just looks like you took like an old oak office desk and like chopped it in half and then glued stuff from your granddad's closet on it. I'm telling you, look this thing up. It's the most bizarre thing you have ever seen in your life. I mean, like, the others are cool. Yeah. There's like Paul Bunyan and there's like one that's like a big pig or something. But this one is just the weirdest thing. And it's fantastic.
Well, and I mean, look, you know, one of our favorite ones is right here in our backyard, SMU versus TCU. You know, they play for an iron skillet. I mean, what's the point of that? But it's awesome. That's how every trophy should be.
Well, that's kind of the epitome of college football, right? Like, I know we play the college football playoff trophy looks like, you know, like a spaceship. It's all pristine and fancy and whatnot. But like, it's the ones that we care about that actually matter to, you know, the vast majority of college football fans are based on skillets and
whatever random object, whatever, like the coach slash athletic director had lying in the back of his Model T and when they played in 1918. Yeah.
I mean, I was just looking up some of the Big Ten ones. There's the old brass spittoon between Indiana and Michigan State.
No,
there's
how
old
is this not like a big deal?
Buckets, right? Well, it's because it's Indiana.
It's true. Indiana. Did they get to 10 wins or was it 9?
They got to 9, I think.
Ah.
Just shy.
This is good. Man, I don't think a 9-win Indiana has come up on this podcast yet.
Listen, man, no,
we're really branching out.
They actually had two very good quarterbacks last year, and I don't know the last time that they could say that they had one. So, you know what? We'll take that.
Hey, I'm all in for good quarterback play.
This is now a Big Ten memorabilia podcast.
Hey, we're getting there. And speaking of quarterbacks, I think if we bring it back to the state of Texas, we have kind of interesting because there's a couple guys that have been around and probably should be good, but I don't know if I really feel that the top of the top is maybe as robust as it has been in recent years.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's sort of a clear top tier, right? And I think that it's really a top two. And I think you're talking about Texas' Sam Ellinger, and I think you're talking about SMU's Shane Buechel. I think those two guys are right now playing on a different level than everybody else. And, you know, obviously, funnily enough, that they used to be in the same room, but I think that both of them have just found really good fits in terms of systems and coaches. And I mean, I think that both of them are playing at a really high level right now. Now, I think after that's when you start to get a little dicier, right? Like you're talking about a Charlie Brewer who's very good. You know, we'll see exactly how good maybe next season. Alan Bowman, who hasn't been healthy. Kellen Mond, who I'm a little on the fence about. But I got to say, I mean, not to pull it back to Rice, but I'm kind of excited to see what Michael Collins can do in this offense.
Yeah, I've actually been, I went back and watched some of his tape from 2018 at TCU. And the physical upside is definitely there, I think.
6'5", 220, 225.
Yeah, and he can really sling it when he's on. I think his trigger needs to be a little quicker at times based on the stuff I've looked at, which is not, I mean, that is a very common problem for college quarterbacks to have, including ones that get drafted highly in the NFL draft sometimes, but hey, what are you going to do? Yeah, so we'll see how he adjusts to the offense and what improvements he's made kind of behind the scenes since he last saw extended action in 2018. But I'm definitely pumped about the upside from a Rice fan perspective.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'll say too is, I mean, if you watch TC's offense the last 2 years, there were just so many other things wrong with it, you know, because a lot of people have kind of just pointed to the quarterbacks, and the quarterbacks have been not very good, obviously, but I mean, that offensive line was falling apart by the end of the season, you know, so like, yes, he definitely needs a quicker trigger. He definitely, you know, isn't maybe at times the most natural reader and thrower, but I mean, not all of that was his fault. And I think, you know, if he can just have 3 seconds back there, right? I mean, I just think that that changes his game so much.
Yeah, when you have Jalen Reagor, a first round pick, and you can't use him, that's a problem.
It's a problem.
Which, I mean, it is TCU, and it's Gary Patterson is probably, I would say, among the most respected coaches in the state, if not in the sport in general. So I would assume that, you know, it's kind of one of those things that is he the Kirk Ferentz of Texas that, you know, like he's always going to be pretty good and he's going to get it back on track. They're not going to have, I mean, has Iowa ever had like back-to-back 3-win seasons? Like, they just go back to 7 wins every year.
Well, and the thing that you say about that is I think that he's Kirk Ferentz and he's actually had more upside, you know,
yeah,
in terms of that.
Won.
Yeah.
Right. And
he doesn't quite have Ferentz's ability to win precisely between 7 and 9 games, like right. nine out of every 10 years.
Right.
But
the go-to stat for Gary Patterson is that he's had, well, up until this last season, and let's just say I'm not as optimistic that this trend will continue next year, but he's had three losing seasons heading into this year. And in the seasons after that, his teams have gone like 33-5. Like, they just are never bad 2 years in a row. Now, again, I think that trend might change this year, but you know, I mean, he does such a good job of preventing that from happening. And I think that's what's been the most surprising thing about the last 2 years, is that this doesn't happen. You know, this just doesn't.
Which is bizarre, but I mean, well, he's earned enough staying power that, I mean, shoot, he's never leaving town. Like, I mean, he's had offers to go elsewhere, but it's one of those things. It's like, you know, I can't envision a TCU without Gary Patterson.
Yeah. Someday it's going to happen. I mean, and I think that Gary's definitely the type who would just decide one day that he's going to leave. Like, I think that he'd pull a Chris Peterson or a Bob Stoops or something like that. But yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what, even when he leaves, I mean, that guy's going to be front and center at Texas Christian University, whether or not he's the football coach.
Does he have a statue yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they actually, oh, man, I think that it was like 2015 that they put it in. And I don't remember the situation, but they basically came and asked him, can we just do it like a donor wants to do it? And he's like, fine. But I don't, it's just, he's a weird dude. But yes, he does have a statue.
A weird, sweaty dude.
Very good football.
Wait, so I'm trying to think, like, how many other active college football coaches, or just coaches at any time, have played on a university where there's a statue of them on campus? Like, Nick Saban doesn't even have that.
Right. Yes, he does. He does.
He does?
Yep. Okay. Yeah. They built one immediately after his... At Alabama, the hard rule is, like, you win a championship, you get a statue. And, like, so, like, the moment 2009 happened, they were like... Statue time.
What do you do after six?
Six statues. You just got to start making statues of like Miss Terry and their dogs and all those, you know, everybody.
It's honestly shocking that Miss Terry does not have a statue already, because I'll tell you, if there's one person in Tuscaloosa and the state of Alabama that's more powerful than Nick Saban, it's his wife.
Yeah.
She runs the show.
No, the Sabans run that state. I mean, look, but yeah, I think that getting back to your question, I mean, I don't know who else does. I mean, obviously, I think that probably, you know, obviously Paterno did back then when, you know, obviously a lot's changed. You know, I'm not sure whether Dabo has one, though. I'm sure one will go up pretty soon. I don't know who else. I mean, it's a short list. And I mean, I think that tells you everything about how much Gary Patterson has meant to TCU, which is everything. And I mean, the other thing, too, that you say about it is out of those guys who have statues, who are coaching in front of statues, and Bill Snyder might be another one who did before he retired. But, you know, when you're talking about those guys, I mean, Gary Patterson's really one of the only guys who's done that who hasn't won a national title. But, you know, still what he's been able to do for TCU is held in such high regard that, I mean, you know, they'll probably name the stadium after him when he retires.
Yeah, I think the thing about Gary Patterson and TCU in general is they've been able to achieve something that very few programs in the history of college football really have, making that jump from I mean, whatever the tiers and levels have changed over time, but making that jump from a group of five school from the Mountain West into a power conference and earning a seat at the table with the big boys, so to speak, like that. Like, you look at TCU and Utah, I think, are probably the two examples of teams that have done it. Even Boise State hasn't. And so every school that is, I mean, you think about the Houstons, the SMUs, the Rices of the world are looking at trying to figure out how do we become the next TCU, or better, but at least making that jump up. I know, realignment is the favorite off-season topic, and now we're in the longest off-season ever. But maybe right. Not just, you know, making that jump to the Big 12 or whatever, but from a big picture standpoint, is there any of the Texas, you know, group of five, FCS, you know, lower level schools that you really like the future, but whether it be the coach or the investment or the direction they're heading?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think that obviously Rice, I think, is one where I really like the direction that they're going. I think that my big question about them was, could they actually get the type of kids that they need to get to be able to play the style of football that they wanted? And, you know, for this level, I think that they've done a really good job of doing that. And they did it quicker than I think I expected in a lot of ways. Now, still has to show up on the field, but I'm really interested in seeing what happens. You know, another school that I'd say that about is SMU. I think that SMU has really a good chance of leveraging what some of they did last year and kind of pushing it forward. I think it's a big deal that they get to keep Shane Buechel for another year. I think it's a big deal that they stole Garrett Riley as offensive coordinator from App State. I mean, they're doing a lot of little things right that make me think that they don't plan on this being a one-year thing. Now, again, I mean, they still have only done it for 1 year, but I think that they're in the process of building something there. And if you want to go down to the sub FBS ranks too, you know, one program and one coach that I really like is Colby Carthel over at Stephen F. Austin. I mean, he won a Division II national title at Texas A&M Commerce, and you know, SFA kind of took a chance on him because he hadn't coached obviously at the Division I level, but you know, he is a rock solid recruiter. He's one of those types of coaches who just, like, you know, with bubblegum and string just puts together offenses and has really had a lot of success at the sub FBS level. And last year wasn't the best season for them. I think they went 2-9, but I really think that in 2, 3, 4 years with the way that they're putting things together, I think that they could be a special team.
Yeah. I always like, it's always funny to me when you get coaches like that who are really successful at lower levels, you know, whether it be FCS, you know, Division 1, 2, 3, and those sorts of things. And okay, it's one thing if you're, you know, a superpower program and there's a certain level of structure and booster interference and all those sorts of things that even, you know, Group of Five schools don't have to deal with, that you kind of wonder if a coach can make that transition. But like, I mean, I think about like Chris Kleeman, okay, who, mm-hmm. you know, is coach at NDSU for like 5 years and wins like 5 straight national championships and loses what, like 1-2 games that whole time. And
probably needs a statue.
I don't think they even give you a statue at NDSU for winning championships. I think that's just the expectation.
I think you just get to keep your job.
Yeah. But I remember when he first got hired by Kansas State last year, like a lot of Kansas State fans were like, oh, why are we getting an FCS coach? But like, it always surprises me how that there's hesitancy to just take guys like that who were just winners, who have done it at every level that they've done it. Because I mean, you look at like Lance Leipold at Buffalo.
Yeah. I was going to bring him up. You know, I think that to jump from D3 to FBS and have success so quickly, I mean, obviously there are differences. I mean, you know, again, I cover football across classifications. You watch a D3 game, you know, you can't run the same types of offense, obviously, that you can at an FBS school. But like, I just think that's people who are elite culture setters and people who are elite managers and people who are elite, you know, talent evaluators, for example, and guys who can develop at a high level. I mean, those are skills that are transferable, right? Those are transferable mm-hmm. at any level. And I think, you know, look, you have to be careful about which guys you pick because there are other situations. You know, obviously, you know, Texas State didn't have success with Everett Withers, bringing him up from James Madison. Like, it doesn't always work that way, so you have to be careful. But I think that if you're really careful about what you're trying to get out of a coach, I think that, you know, looking at some of those lower levels, I mean, like you said, success is success. And you can hire an offensive coordinator that coaches a more high-level offense. You can hire a defensive coordinator. You can hire guys to help. But I mean, if you've got a guy who's used to winning and especially knows how to do it, I think that those are things that definitely can translate.
Yeah. And if nothing else, when you bring in somebody like that, there's hope that, you know, I've been talking with all sorts of folks in the midst of putting together my season preview for whenever we'll get to that next, whenever this coming season right. is going to happen. But with talking with folks for the past couple of years, I'm not going to bag on UTEP, but I'm going to bring up Dana Dimmel. When he was hired, he was not a up and coming, you know, maybe his best is yet ahead of him. We kind of knew what he was. He was he was pretty good at Wyoming and was fine to not great at Houston and was a pretty, like, I would say, respected coordinator. but coming in at UTEP, what his hiring was not something that was met with fanfare. I think you like if we go to talk in state and you go to North Texas and what they've gotten going there, he's become a rising name in the coaching ranks, and maybe not for actually accomplishing all that much so far at North Texas, but you know, there's the possibility that he could someday. You know, we just don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's there's a lot of different directions you can go when you're trying to hire a coach, right? And like, I think that the funny thing about UTEP, you know, and I've talked to Dana Dimel a lot. I like him, but like, I think that even
he's
at the
really time,
he's a
good guy. Aside, yeah,
he's a great guy. He's a great, great guy. And I mean, I think that he really cares, and I think he really wants to succeed. But I think that, you know, at the time, you could say it wasn't the most imaginative hire. I don't think that they sort of laid the infrastructure in place to be able to do the K-State thing, which is what I think they had in mind when they hired him. I don't, you know, and at the flip side of that, like, I do think that there are situations where trying to hire the hot next thing, you know, get ahead of the curve, you know, that backfires. I mean, I think that, you know, another guy who I like a lot, Frank Wilson at UTSA. I mean, they tried to hire the guy who was the electric young guy in the room, who was going to recruit at a high level, was going to attract talent, was going to, you know, whatever. And it just doesn't work. Right. I mean, it's different skill sets. Even Cliff Kingsbury, I think, is sort of an example of that at Texas Tech at times. You know, so it's just risky. I mean, any hire is risky, obviously, but, you know, I also understand why teams kind of prioritize the things that they do.
Yeah. There's no one right answer. At least nobody has figured that out yet. And once they do, they're not telling us.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing I'll say real quick is again, you know, you look at SMU, you're kind of hiring a retread, right? In Sonny Dykes. You kind of feel like, oh, you know, he had success at La Tech, but he got a chance at the big time at Cal and it didn't really go well. I mean, I remember, you know, I went to Baylor and I covered them for a while. Like, I remember when Sonny Dykes was being rumored as a coach after, you know, when they ended up hiring Matt Rhule, and people were not excited. People were not about it. And, you know, I think that I maybe even had a slightly negative perception of him too, but you see what he can do when he's put in the right situation. Like, sometimes you have to take those gambles, you know, and sometimes it works out, but I mean, hiring coaches is a fickle game, obviously.
Yeah. It's such a, I mean, one, it's all about fit, I think is probably the biggest thing. Like, I think so many of us get caught up in wanting to describe coaches. Like we tend to do this thing where we just look at a coach's track record or recent track record, and we're just like, that guy's a good coach, that guy's a bad coach. And it's never anywhere near that simple, because you know, it just sometimes the reason that a guy failed or succeeded at a previous job aren't conditions that are going to exist in any way, shape, or fashion at the next one.
Well, if you want to pull from your roots, Carter, and just look at Nick Saban, I mean, what he was able to accomplish at Michigan State, he was good. He wasn't Nick Saban. And then, of course, yeah, the NFL that didn't work out for one reason or another, and then comes to Alabama. When he's hired by Alabama, you can correct me if I'm wrong from the inside, but there wasn't any expectation that he was going to become Nick Saban. They thought they were going to hire a really good football coach and be competitive. They didn't think they were rechristening Bear Bryant.
Yeah, I mean, well, he was their second choice after Rich Rodriguez, who turned them down because his wife didn't want to live in Tuscaloosa. As far as I remember, at the time, we were excited in that fan base. Like, there was a thought that that he could kind of get us back to the position that Alabama fans view Alabama as needing to be, should be in college football. But yeah, I mean, I mean, 5 national championships in over what, 8-9 seasons. You're not going to expect that from anyone.
Well, and I mean, you know, I'm not going to say that I was right around that, but I mean, I think that it probably was kind of similar to sort of the Chip Kelly situation, right? Where you're like, all right, here's a guy who obviously was a great college coach, but it's been a couple years, you know, you just never know if it's going to be a right fit. Obviously, Alabama at the time, I mean, I think people forget just how weird that job was at the time. But I mean,
oh, yeah,
like you said, I mean, the ability to go in there, get everybody in alignment, get all the boosters in alignment. Like, you just can't necessarily project that.
So if you had to, and I these are not level playing fields, so I'm going to ask you an unfair question, but
okay.
I believe in you. If you had, how about this, relative to program expectations, you know, what do you think about the two new hires at the FBS level in the state of Texas with Jeff Traylor at UTSA and Dave Aranda at Baylor? What do you kind of think at the outlook at those guys for their programs?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, at this point, UTSA's goal was to try to get somebody who could recruit. And I think that the early signs that we've seen from him are good, right? Like, I think that we knew that he was going to come in and sell and, you know, evaluate all the right players, get the right guys. But I mean, I think that it's been interesting to see him kind of actually do it, right? Because that was sort of the message with Frank Wilson, too, was we got to raise the level of talent on campus. He's going to come into Texas. He's going to go into Louisiana. He's going to, you know, get all this talent. And it happened to some extent, but I don't know if it really happened in this way so quickly, right? And, you know, and I think that, you know, starting with Traylor, I think that he was able to hire some good assistants. I'm glad he hired a guy who has, you know, 20 years as a coordinator in Tyrone Nix. I'm glad that he hires the guy in Barry Lunney, who was who was a position coach for a long time under a lot of different coaches. But again, the thing to me that's kind of the question with them, and I don't know whether they've answered it very well, and I don't know if they're going to be able to answer it before the season, is what do they actually want to look like? You know, what is Jeff Traylor's identity as a college head coach? We know what it was in high school. You know, he was a high powered offensive guy, but like, he is one of those guys who at Gilmer was basically doing the bubblegum and string thing, right? You know, so like, that's not going to be how it's going to be at UTSA to the same extent. But I mean, you know, look, I think that if they could have had him a couple years ago when he was coming off of that Texas stint, I think that everybody would have felt differently about it than coming off of being fired at Arkansas. So I'm curious to see what they've learned from that experience. And, you know, moving to Baylor and Dave Aranda, I mean, I think that it was an interesting hire. It's not who I expected them to hire. I thought that they'd go with a current head coach. I didn't think that they'd go with a coordinator. And look, I mean, the funny thing about it is Matt Rhule and Dave Aranda are the opposite people. Like, they are as different as you can possibly be. You know, Matt Rhule is a big out there, talk big, be a leader, be a, you know, be sort of almost a preacher vibe to him. Like, he is the cheerleader for an organization. And Dave Aranda is more of sort of the, like, sit back, think through things, make all the right decisions, but be very quiet about it. Like, the funny thing is, you know, I mean, I'm sure that you guys haven't necessarily seen Dave Aranda press conferences, but they are not, you know, super engaging.
He's got some things to learn.
He's a really interesting dude. He's not, I would say, a typical personality for a college head coach.
No, and I think that it's, I don't want to say that it's easy to say, but, you know, I think it's in some ways easy to see why teams didn't see him as an obvious next head coach, right? Like, because he is sort of more reserved. But the thing is, you know, when you get him in more of a one-on-one setting, I mean, that dude is honest. That dude is analytical. That dude gets it. Like,
He's so smart.
Right. And like, I mean, I think that it almost gets a little lazy sometimes the way that we talk about him being like an intellectual guy and all that. But like, it really is true.
Yeah.
Like, it really is true. And, you know, I actually got to sit in on one of his clinics at a coaching clinic a while back. And I mean, that dude is just like half the time in that room, like all the high school coaches are like looking around like, what's going on? You know, like he's functioning at that sort of capacity. And look, I think that the thing that makes me more comfortable with this hire too is just, I think he's hired a great staff. You know, I mean, you're hiring.
I love that he got Ron Roberts as his defensive coordinator. I love that hire.
Right. Ron Roberts, who again was also his head coach when they were at Delta State. He was the head coach when Aranda was defense coordinator.
And
the
funny thing, Aranda and Pete Golding were
that's a pretty good staff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that's not even counting on the offensive side of the ball. Obviously, you got Larry Fedora, you know, the former head coach at North Carolina. So I was a little bit hesitant on the hire at first, I think, but getting a chance to talk to him, I mean, again, because he hadn't really spoken at any of Wisconsin or LSU or anything. He'd kind of been behind the scenes, but, you know, getting a chance to speak to him, I think, helped a little bit. And just seeing the staff, I mean, it is up there among the best staffs in Texas. I mean, I think that both of these hires probably ended up at the right place. I think they took some interesting paths to get there. But I think that, you know, Traylor has to show me some stuff on the field before I feel very comfortable. But I mean, I think that you look at the way that Aranda's, you know, hired coaches right now, they're recruiting at a pretty high level right now. They just got quarterback Kyron Drones from Shadow Creek High School to commit. I mean, they're moving in the right direction, I think. And I think, you know, you looked at Baylor and you wondered after Matt Rhule left, would they be able to continue this? I mean, I think that they've showed that they're willing to do what it takes.
Yeah, and they showed with the NFL draft, they showed Matt Rhule in the war room, or I guess his home office now, and wearing Panthers gear. And I still don't believe it. You know, he's one of those guys that you saw him, you're like, you're the head coach. Like it, he just kind of, he became the identity, especially with a program that needed an identity and a culture setter. Like what he was able to bring in so many ways. I saw him and I'm like, Baylor football, this is right. Matt Rhule, isn't? And now he's not there, and I will get used to seeing a different face, but it might take me a while.
It's gonna take some time. And I mean, again, like, Aranda's not gonna be the up there, you know, up front guy either, you know. I mean, and I'm curious what that actually kind of looks like if Baylor gets good, right? You know, because Matt Rhule during this past year was kind of the face of all of it, right? And I mean, it's not like Baylor, if they're good next year, it's not like they have a Robert Griffin. Like, Charlie Brewer's not a talker. You're not necessarily gonna, you know, put him front and center. So I don't know. It's gonna be interesting to see kind of how they market themselves in the next couple of years.
Well, Matt Rhule was the smock of the program, not just the face of the program.
Of course.
Do you think he's going to keep wearing those at Carolina?
You know, the sad thing about it is that I think it was the Athletics.
You had to get him, like, custom made, right?
No. So it was actually part of the Nike rollout that year. And actually, some other teams actually had some similar things. But the deal was, it was made to be like one of those warm-up garments, you know, like one of those things when, like, guys are first getting loose on the field before a game. Like, that's what those things are made for. But then Matt Rhule was like, what if I just wore this and put a t-shirt underneath it? And that's all it was. And it was bizarre. Nobody else tried it, obviously. But unfortunately, in the 2020 Nike catalog, that garment no longer exists.
It's been retired.
It's been retired.
R.I.P. coaching smock.
Can you imagine him in the NFL with that? That would just be so outrageous.
Hey, Bill Belichick has rocked the hoodie for so long. But I mean, did he do it at the beginning? He's kind of developed some cachet.
Yeah. I think that it was a later thing. I mean, I'd have to go back, but I definitely don't think I remember seeing pictures of him with the Browns in a Browns cutoff hoodie.
You have, I feel, to like win, they were like X, a crew amount of titles before. Back.
Yeah.
I definitely remember pictures of Saban in like a very unfortunate looking Browns like crew neck sweater on that sideline. I'm struggling to remember what Belichick's look was back then.
Well, it's funny because I really don't think that we, especially in the NFL, right? Like, I think that we talk a lot about baseball managers having to wear uniforms and how weird that is, but I don't think that we talk about how weird it is that NFL coaches all have to wear things from the Nike catalog. You know, like, it's just, I don't know. I'm not saying that everybody should have to wear a suit or anything like that, but it's just kind of a weird look.
Yeah, it's funny that it's not standardized. They give them such a. I don't think it's good to give men like coaches too much freedom with stuff like that, because they'll do things like Matt Rhule will, like, where just like, what if I wear that warm up as a, what if I just put a t-shirt under that? It's like, okay. Coach, just do the football. It's comfy. I'll keep wearing it. I like it. Like, it's a,
well, this is college football. There are no rules.
Well, you know, look, I mean, obviously we're from Texas, and so, you know, we can't do this. But for me, the perfect look is always going to be what's the Wisconsin coach's name? The one who has just like the crew neck sweater that just says Wisconsin.
Paul, Paul Chryst.
Yeah, Paul Chryst. Yeah, that's the classic look to me. And actually, Baylor did run that out with their staff one of the games last year, and it looked phenomenal. But obviously, you can't do that in Texas all year long.
I'm just waiting to see, and I guess we can kind of pan forward and pull out our crystal balls. I'm waiting to see if that we do have a college football season that gets delayed or moved or something like that, and we are playing, you know, hypothetically, you know, it's February 3rd weekend of February, and Minnesota is playing a home game. What is PJ Fleck wearing for his opening kickoff if we get there? It's not going to be a smock.
Well, I think the question's going to be, you know, how used to Minnesota has PJ Fleck gotten? You know, because this is the deal, right? You can't be the coach at Minnesota and be bundled up looking cold. Like, that's not allowed. You're not allowed to do that. So, I mean, he better acclimate quickly.
Oh, man. And I remember, so Antonio Montero was starting linebacker for Rice, is from Minnesota. And not this past spring, but the spring prior, so that would have been the spring of 2019, it was really cold through February and the beginning of March. And so Rice started practice. And the first day of practice, it was like high 30s and raining. And it was awful. And all the Texas boys are out there bundled up, wearing 7 layers and as many, you know, sweatshirts and whatever as they can put on over their bodies. And Montero's out there in shorts and a t-shirt, just laughing and pointing at everybody. And we get there's some folks from, like, Rice recruits everywhere. So there's some folks from all over the country, but he was the only one that I distinctly remember as being brave enough to say, no, I can do this. It's fine.
I just don't get the point, man. What are you trying to prove?
Fleck strikes me as the type of guy that, like, we all know that guy from college. I mean, like, we all went to college in Texas, so there's only like 1 week of cold weather a year. But like, we all know that one guy who was like, it's 30 degrees for that 1 week, and he doesn't own anything warmer than a hoodie. And so you see that one guy who's on campus with just like his college hoodie and his cargo shorts and flip flops, and like, that's what he's wearing. Fleck strikes me as that type of dude, but also like, I don't know, he would like go for a run in that. Like, if he was your roommate, he'd come back to your dorm room, like, having just gone for a run in like Chacos and cargo shorts and his like college hoodie, and be like, "Woo, brace it out there, guys."
Yeah, I think that the deal is, I bet that Fleck does like a pregame like run around the fields wearing like nothing but a, you know, but like a tank top or something, but then he immediately goes in and changes.
You got to use the first part for the promotional video.
Exactly.
He's got the oar, he's rowing the boat. Oh, man. And I joke, but I know, you know, kind of transitioning to whatever the future might look like. And, you know, disclaimer, I don't know you about you, Shahan, but I'm not a medical doctor, nor do I have any infectious disease expertise. So setting that aside, you know, I think we've all heard like various ideas of what college football could look like this year. Ranging from crazy to believable, like, if you had to guesstimate, like, what do you think we're going to be doing?
Right. It's such a tough question. And, you know, and that's not breaking any news to anybody. But I think that, you know, there's a lot of different parts of this, right? Because I think that, for example, a sport like baseball or a sport like basketball, I think it's going to be not too difficult to do those without fans. But I really don't think you can do football without fans. Like, I think that for football to come back, we really have to be in a place where we can have relatively large crowds. Like, I don't think that we can do this, you know, because again, I mean, there's just with players and support staffers and all that, I mean, a football game's already like 400 people, you know, like we're already just starting with that. But I think that we'll definitely know a lot more in 2-3 weeks whenever Texas starts fully opening up and just seeing the spread of it. But from what people are saying, it does sound like we're going to have football at some point in the next calendar year. You know, like you talked about, it could be in the spring, it could be in the fall. I tend to think that I think that we might see a slightly abbreviated season. I think that we might maybe start on time and maybe, you know, cut things off a little earlier or miss some non-conference games, something like that. But, you know, I do think that there's a pretty good chance that we get something this fall. It's just so hard to know where exactly we'll be as a country when that happens.
Yeah, and it's so difficult because I'm sitting here thinking, and for me, just as an individual who likes football, and I'm thinking about, like, when am I going to feel comfortable going into a stadium with, I mean, you're going to Austin or College Station that has 100,000 people in it. Like, and even if, you know, I mean, you know, go with a mandate if it's only 25% of that, that's 25,000 people. Like,
yeah,
that's the point where, like, if me going personally, if I'm going to go sit in a press box that has, you know, maybe what, 20 writers and we're all spaced 10, 15 feet apart, like, that's fine. I have no qualms there, but like, I can completely envision a world where, like, even if the games are opened up, like, there's going to be a lot of people that say, I have a big screen TV at home and I can get a case of beer for the price of one.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, I think that might maybe be the best way for this to happen, you know, is for it to kind of be open and people just to be wary. Because, I mean, look, I think anybody projecting at what point we're going to know when deaths are kind of trickling off and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I don't think we're going to know. And the funny thing about all of this, too, is, like, we have actually, in a lot of ways, done such a good job of slowing the curve that we haven't developed maybe herd immunity as quickly as, you know, as we maybe would have projected to, right? So, like, I mean, that was always sort of the flip side is, you know, it's going to maybe take longer if we do flatten the curve, which obviously we needed to do, which we have to do. But you know, it does make sort of the next couple months really scary because we don't necessarily know what's going to happen. Like South Korea, you know, which is the country that's done the best job of curbing all of this. They're dealing with really, really strict limitations, which is how they've dealt with it. And, you know, just with having 50 states, having the population that we do, having the population density that we do, and obviously then throwing football and that density into it, too. I mean, it's just going to be so many factors to take into account. And the one thing that I'll say, too, is don't pay attention to these schools saying we're planning to be open in the fall because they don't know anything either, right? Like, I mean, the University of Oklahoma saying we're going to be open in the fall does not mean anything because all that's about, right? Like, you can almost even look. It's like they want students to commit to come there in the fall. They're not ready.
They want people to pay tuition and people to buy those student tickets or the season tickets.
Exactly. And they don't know anything either, right? So none of these things are good signs as yet until we actually know something about the virus. But again, there's just so many things to take into account. And obviously, we haven't remotely even talked about, obviously, the necessity for athletic departments for football to happen. So, I mean, it's such a complicated issue.
It's particularly tricky. And then it gets to the point where, like, and I think some people have kind of played this out and thought into it. I've heard that, maybe not that this is in the, I mean, nothing is immediate, right? It's all kind of hurry up and wait and just kind of see what, but there have been discussions and questions of what happens if, you know, I think you have Texas does a great job. They are the best in the best state in the country and they crush this and it comes to September and they're ready to go play football. Like, that's great. Rice is playing Army this season. Texas A&M is playing Colorado. Like New York, like Colorado, like there's so many non-conference games and even conference games, like Rice is supposed to fly out to Huntington, West Virginia. What if you come to a place where Texas is ready to play football, but nobody else is?
Well, and I think that you need to, like, I think it's a necessity that we have sort of a universal clearance, right? Like, I don't think that you can go piecemeal. Like you said, I mean, TCU opens at Cal. You know, California is probably going to be one of the last states that finally rolls things back, along with New York, like you mentioned, you know, with Rice playing against Army. Like, that's just how this is going to have to work. And I think that if you're the NCAA, if you're college football, if you're, you know, the committees and all that, like, you can't open this up and try to say we're mostly open, right? Like, you have to say we are doing this or we are not. Like, I don't think it's fair to anybody to say, well, just because, you know, the virus is gone in North Dakota means that North Dakota State can play, but JMU can't because they're in Virginia. You know, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, the asymmetry of it just makes it so, and the distribution of population centers just makes it so complicated because you can't, like, it's not a situation like, you know, where in a, you know, take South Korea, for instance, like, obviously they have had a response that is much better than ours, but also, like, South Korea is geographically small enough that, like, you can view the country itself as being, like, kind of a singular outbreak, right? And obviously the disclaimer that I am not an epidemiologist, so I'm sort of speaking off the cuff here, but, like, the U.S. is so spread out that, like, you're not dealing with one out. You're not just, like, looking at a curve for the whole U.S. and saying, all right, we're at this point of the curve, open everything back up again. Like, what you're essentially dealing with is 50, 100 communities that you can consider as their own kind of units as far as outbreaks and containment measures go. So the whole thing just becomes vastly more logistically complicated just because of that.
Well, right. And even within states, I mean, like you mentioned, Texas, like Texas as a whole, you know, we can point to all these sort of rural areas that haven't had any issues, but then, you know, I'm in Dallas, and Dallas has had more of a hard time, right? Like, we've spread it a little bit more than other places have. And it's like, so what, do you piecemeal that even more, where you're like, okay, well, you know, UT and SMU and Baylor can't play, but Texas Tech can play. You know, you just can't do that. Like, you have to sort of get a clearance across the board. And I mean, look, I think that, you know, in the long run, if sort of this phase idea that Texas is doing does end up working out without too many complications, which is not sure something I'm confident about, but if it does happen, you know, obviously that does open the door. You know, I mean, I think that we're going to need to know by mid-July whether things are going to be good to go for the season for it to start on time. You know, if we can start getting some of those answers in the next few weeks, that's going to make sort of the re-entry into the population a little bit more likely. But again, we're going to have to unfortunately be the test subjects starting really on Friday. And I don't know. I'm obviously nervous, just like everybody else is.
Yeah. And I'm going to be sitting at my home office and letting others do the bold testing if they would like to. But and then I know this is I had heard this and I wrote on the site that it was kind of a pie in the sky thing that someone had thrown out as an idea that was not being given serious consideration by any decision makers, but it is at least being talked about in college football circles. I don't know if you would come across this yet or not, but the idea of especially with financial implications that conferences are already looking at, you know, their non-conference schedule and regionalizing scheduling for Olympic sports in particular, but even some discussions to football. I know this is, at this point, it seems like a pipe dream, and it probably is, but that's what we said. Like, we didn't envision the world we were in today, you know, when the NBA shut down and then everything changed. So if for some reason that the only foreseeable financial way to make football happen this year in the state of Texas was to create an all Texas league and to put Texas and Rice and Houston and UTEP and North Texas and SMU all together, would that not be the Texas sports writer dream season given everything we're dealing with?
Well, I can answer that pretty easily. Yes, it would obviously be the Texas sports writer dream. You know, and I do think that, you know, I think that schools have to at least consider some measures when it comes to non-conference scheduling, right? Like, I mean, not that anything's going to happen. I don't have any inside information on this, but, you know, I do think that, you know, both from a, you know, travel perspective, like you mentioned, from a safety perspective, I mean, there's just a different danger with TCU going to Cal versus TCU going to SMU, right? Like, it's just different. And I think that another thing, too, to kind of take into account is, like, one of the benefits of keeping some of those matchups in state, and again, I don't know whether that would be for 2020 or heading forward, but, you know, one of the benefits of that is that you'd keep a lot of that money in state too, right? Like, you'd keep Texas's payout in state instead of them going to LSU or whatever, right? Like, I mean, you'd keep some of that non-conference money in state, and I think that would be a draw. And I mean, look, I think that obviously from, like, a true conference perspective, you know, all this stuff has to do with TV contracts and all that sort of stuff. I mean, that's really what ties this stuff together. But, you know, I think that maybe from a non-conference perspective, there could be some flexibility. And I think that you mentioned Olympic sports. I mean, you know, one idea that I'd seen thrown around my Twitter timeline the past couple of days is in general changing up, you know, sort of conference scheduling when it comes to Olympic sports and kind of making those more regional in general, like long term, not necessarily just for this season. I mean, I think that that's something to think about. You know, do we need the Big 12 to exist the exact same way in football as it does in basketball, as it does in volleyball? You know, I think that that's a fair question to ask. I mean, I think that it would take some creative decision makers and people sort of willing to go against the grain in some ways. But I mean, I think long term, that would be a good thing to save costs, you know, because why are you making, if you're Texas Tech, why are you making your volleyball team go to West Virginia? You know, like it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense versus, you know, because obviously, you know, from a payout perspective and from a funding perspective, like Rice football and Texas Tech football are on different levels right now. But like Rice volleyball and Texas Tech football are, you know, on the same level. And Rice in a lot of ways is obviously been very successful at volleyball, you know, so maybe that kind of changes the calculus a little bit. Again, we don't necessarily have any information to think that that might be the case. But I mean, I think that that's the sort of thing that long term, I mean, you know, should be a consideration.
Yeah. Well, and it's not like it's totally unprecedented. Like there are already schools that have like differing conference memberships for different sports because we know one school doesn't or conference doesn't sponsor a particular sport or things like that. I think that's a really good point that like, you know, it's one thing in football or basketball where the, you know, the economics work out and the TV deals are there, but like, why does the Rice track team need to go to Old Dominion? Like, what sense does that make in any, at any level, really, other than like it's economically tied to like the higher revenue sports?
Right. Well, and I mean, someday go look up the Big 12 Wrestling League because it is all over the place. I mean, it's like North Dakota State, I think, is in it. I think Army's in it. Like, we definitely do have precedence for this. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, it's not unprecedented to see that. And I mean, you have the school. I think that Iowa State doesn't have baseball, for example, right? Like, so why is it important for them to be a part of the conference in that perspective? And, you know, why is it that, you know, Rice baseball isn't part of it necessarily, or whoever else, Houston baseball or whoever? I mean, obviously schools value sports different ways, and you'd almost, I think, be better off trying to regionalize some of it so that, again, you know, you're not going across the country to play a sport, you know, putting somebody on a bus to go somewhere where they really shouldn't be going on a bus to.
Yeah. And you bring up Rice baseball. Like I've seen firsthand, you bring Texas to town. That was so Rice got to play a quarter of a season. They opened up against Texas and that series, that was a sold out, like, I don't know, probably 15,000 people there for a 3-game series. And it was a fantastic atmosphere. And yes, I mean, it was the beginning of the season, but Rice in Texas, you play that game anywhere. Rice in Houston midweek, Rice in A&M midweek. Like, that is so much more of an economic driver because people and butts in the seats than, like, people are showing up to see Rice and Southern Miss. And those are probably two of, like, probably the better perennially Conference USA programs.
Yeah, but, and I mean, then you can also sort of, you know, in a way, prioritize things too, right? Like, I mean, again, I don't have a great example off the top of my head, but, you know, like, let's say that UTEP does not value baseball, for example, but obviously they value basketball a lot, right? Like, then you can kind of say, you know, well, we're going to maybe have some of these more regional leagues and, you know, maybe UTEP can compete in more of a higher basketball conference versus, you know, maybe they can't compete in other conferences, you know, and it just kind of, I think, ties everybody together a little more. And again, like, I'm not a college baseball guy, but like, you know what, when my alma mater Baylor played against A&M, that's fun, right? Like, getting to play some of the teams that are close by and, you know, Texas versus Texas A&M is always a big draw. Like, I just think, I wish that all of the dynamics surrounding sports weren't driven so much by football, because there's just so much more out there.
Yeah. And like, in the Conference USA footprint, I always have to do a double take when, and I'm assuming that neither of you closely follow Conference USA men's soccer,
Can't say I do.
Yeah. So, but would it surprise you at all to learn that the membership of Conference USA Soccer includes Kentucky and South Carolina?
That absolutely would surprise me. But I mean, you know, that's yeah. like, that's sort of the
it's
thing.
It's not
right?
as uncommon as we would think.
No.
It would.
No, not at all. And I mean, that's the thing, you know, men's soccer is just one of the sports that doesn't get sponsored the same way. Right. And, yeah. and like, you know, I think
it's,
that we,
it's so often like a title, not like, right. I mean, I speaking for both of my schools, like neither Rice nor Alabama sponsors men's soccer. Like, and those, right. you know, those are schools that are on totally different levels and kind of a lot of things, but like, and I think it also makes sense from just like a student perspective. I think sometimes there are a lot of people who are quick to sort of roll their eyes at pointing out the student in student athlete. And look, in a lot of contexts, that is very true. I completely understand there. I am kind of the opinion that amateurism is a fraud myself, but like, or a sham, but like for students that aren't, for athletes that aren't expected to go pro that are in sports where there aren't really opportunities to go pro, which is true for a lot of them. Like the student part still matters. And so, you know, when you're, it's one thing in football, like, okay, you play one game a week and, you know, you get used to that scheduling and your trips are on the weekends and it's fine. But like, you know, if you're in a sport that has to take, that has to play a bunch of games and do a bunch of midweek trips, like, I don't know. I have a lot of respect for the people that are on those teams that have to deal with that constant disruption to their schedules, to be like going on midweek plane trips while they're supposed to be in class, like to have a swim meet in Colorado or something like
right.
that.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, you know, is that I know that, for example, like for Big 12 teams, Wednesday is always a volleyball day, you know, and we think about sort of sports in the context of sort of the big sports. But I mean, like the volleyball team isn't taking a chartered plane there, right? Like even the basketball teams do potentially, like we're talking about them getting on a bus and driving up to Iowa one day. And like, it is a big disruption and it is a lot of stress just from a travel perspective to put on them. And again, if there's no reason for it necessarily, there's no reason that a volleyball athlete should have to drive up to Iowa or fly to West Virginia or whatever it is just to play a conference match when again, I mean, there are lots of other schools in the state of Texas that take this very seriously too.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, it's one of those things that we didn't like a month ago, like everything changed. I'm curious as to see, and we won't really know, but when we sit down at this point, you know, maybe next year or 2 years when we fully, everything is back to whatever the new equilibrium we have found it is. Like I have no idea. I have no idea where any of this is going to go. And that's what kind of makes it so interesting.
So I do have one question for you guys. So obviously today, you know, obviously today they passed sort of the name image likeness stuff. So now it looks like to at least some extent, there's going to be opportunities for endorsements, things like that. So I'm curious, as you know, as Rice people, as Conference USA people, you know, how do you think that it's going to impact your guys' situation? And the other thing too is, do you think that there is sort of a market there for some of the Olympic sports athletes at Rice to really have a platform?
Yeah. So my first thought there is that I think a lot of people who have a vested interest in keeping these sorts of things of from student athletes from making any money off athletics of things like that, they tend to sort of concern troll about schools like Rice, about schools in the G5 and the FCS and stuff like that. And they're like, oh, it's going to create these inequities. Like you're going to have the schools with the most resources getting all the best players. That already happens.
Wouldn't you hate for Texas to get a lot of players?
Like, oh no, you mean an Alabama booster's gonna spend all his money to get Alabama a bunch of five stars? That already happens. Like, it's to pretend that the influence of money is somehow going to change the balance of power and obviously there's such a, you know, well, you mentioned it right there in your question about like Olympic sports, for instance, but like, we look at it through the lens of like football and men's basketball so much. And you're talking about sports that are already so stratified that I think that is a thing that people bring up so much is that it's going to cause the stratification, when in reality, I don't know how it can possibly get more stratified than it already is. So in that sense, I really don't have a huge amount of concern about that. As far as Olympic athletes go and opportunities and, you know, whether there is a market for those things, I think probably the opportunity for them comes not so much from, like, you know, it's one thing if, you know, Jimmy Booster decides that he wants, you know, the Players at State U to get like a do nothing job endorsing his car dealership and give them $50,000 for that. Like, you know, that's not going to happen for, you know, swimmers or volleyball players or whatever. But like, you know, right now they're prohibited from doing things like making money off a YouTube channel or anything where they can build a brand for themselves. And so that, I think, is going to be where the opportunity really comes in for these people, because, you know, there's so much opportunity for people in the very like digital media driven world we live in for people to essentially make opportunities for themselves. You know, there are Twitch streamers who earn millions of dollars a year, you know, that sorts of things. Like, I'm not saying that's going to happen for every, you know, Olympic sport athlete at colleges and universities in the US, but like, there are some people out there probably who could, you know, do pretty fine for themselves doing those sorts of things. So well, I
think that's, you know, for me, I mean, again, I went to Baylor, like I mentioned a couple of times. Like, I mean, I think that I just look at it, right? And everybody thinks of it through football and even men's basketball. But like, I mean, Baylor had the volleyball national player of the year, right? Like, you're telling me that she couldn't get any ad deals or sponsorships or anything like that? Like, and I look at Oklahoma State, I mean, their wrestling team, they're gods on campus. And you look at Oklahoma, you know, they have the best gymnast of all time. And even at Rice, I mean, Erica Agumake, right? Like, you're telling me that nobody would have been interested in her. I just don't think that that's necessarily true. And again, I mean, even from a football perspective, like, if you're the best player, if you're Mason Fine, you think that Mason Fine's less valuable than the 84th guy at Alabama? Like, I just don't think that's true.
Well, and I think it's interesting, and so this is interesting because having these conversations, it's very different who you're talking to, whether or not we're sitting here hashing things out with folks in media or just on Twitter or whatnot, and I'm talking to these coaches, and everyone has an opinion on how it's going to directly impact them, and I've heard both. I'd say that probably most of the folks that I know in the coaching arena are more hesitant to change. I feel like that's pretty stereotypical, you know, from football to baseball to whatever.
Coaches hate change?
No, what? Right. They like money and hate change. Just like the rest of us. They just have more of it than we do. But yeah, so I think the optics aren't going to change. Like, Alabama's not going to get more better at football, and the halves are not going to become any more halves than they already have. And the knots are not going to become any more knots. Like, the stratification exists. But I think of, like, and this is interesting because one of the things that I've enjoyed about Rice is it's such a tight-knit community that I've gotten to really know the folks and the marketing and the graphics and promotions side of the administration. And through talking with them, just on social media, the power of an individual is so much greater than that of any, like, sponsored account. Like, I don't even know what it is, right, but go find Tua on Twitter, right, and then go find the Alabama football account. And if Tua tweets something out, more people listen than if Alabama football does, because there's the personal connection. Like, they've done studies and proven that's true. And I'm just thinking from like a Rice perspective, like, Trey Crews, I think, is a perfect example for this. Like, the Crews family is so big in the city of Houston. And if Trey Crews gets, I mean, Buffalo Wild Wings, like, in on Kirby, like, or, you know, like, or in Rice Village in that area, like, something like that. It doesn't have to go be like a national, like, advertising campaign, but like Trey Crews getting his face out there associated with something and saying, by the way, he plays baseball for Rice University. Like, more people are going to come to Rice games if they know a Crews is at Rice. And that's an effort. Like, I feel like it's not just all like, yes, the athletes are going to benefit, but like, I feel like this is a two-way street where we're promoting your individuals is going to build your brand.
Right. And I mean, and I really do think, like you mentioned, I mean, that it doesn't limit to football. In fact, I think that football is going to be one of the less interesting ways that it impacts things, you know, because a lot of the dynamics are just going to be the same. But like you mentioned, I mean, getting a baseball player, getting a gymnast, getting a, you know, and I think that that's one of the things too, where like having a program that is maybe outsized at your university, you kind of get double the exposure from that. And again, like I mentioned, Baylor women's basketball, like you can build a brand anywhere, but like sort of the following that they have, I think gives them a unique advantage there. And I don't know. I think that everybody's just thinking about it with as sort of like an opportunity to money launder. And I just don't think that that's going to be the primary way that this changes things.
Yeah. Well, I think you both like kind of synthesizing things you both mentioned, like, you know, when you have, like, it doesn't have to be national. It doesn't have to be like Zion Williamson is not the only person that benefits from this. If, you know, if it was allowed when he was in school, like, it's not just like the most prominent national stars in the biggest sports having deals with like Nike or Adidas. It's like, okay, like lots of places don't care about college gymnastics, but like in the SEC, gymnastics is huge. Like in Baton Rouge, they love LSU gymnastics. Like, and so it, like, it doesn't have to be a big regional thing. It like, I think we forget about that there is still value and kind of power in like these localized communities where things that don't matter on, you know, don't matter, but like don't matter on a national scale matter to people in these smaller communities. Like, you don't think an LSU gymnast could benefit from like a deal with someone in Baton Rouge? Like,
well, and I think in a lot of ways, you know, the benefit too might be you keep some of these kids around. And like the example that always comes to mind is Katie Ledecky. Like, how the heck is Katie Ledecky not an NCAA swimmer, right? Like, because she had to pick between, am I going to take the sponsorship? Or am I going to take, you know, the education and be able to compete in the NCAA? So it's just, that's such an unfair decision to make someone make. And I'm glad that hopefully to some extent, I mean, they'll be able to put it aside. And I think too, it's good for a lot of these sports because if you do have some revenue stream, for example, like I think of some players that I've known in the past who just had to leave school for financial reasons. I mean, if you take at least some of that away, not all of it, I'm not saying that they're going to make $1 million by being, you know, a student athlete at whatever school, but like, if you just take some of that pressure away, I think that it really does end up benefiting college sports in a lot of ways.
Man, I guess we'll see. Like, put that on the entire list of, you know, things looking out end of April, going into May of questions that we would like to have answered and how sports will look in the future. We'll see. I'm optimistic. I feel like at this point, like it's been coming for so long that we're going to get there. It's just a win and how that plays out. I don't know. And once we get there, can we please get NCAA football back? A side note,
please. Yeah.
But I did see, I think the NCAA put out some statement earlier today about it, and we're recording, and I did see that Nicole Auerbach from The Athletic tweeted it and synthesized it and basically said getting everyone together on the same page for a large group of athletes across the country is so hard that there's no way this is coming back.
It's basically you can't do it without a union, and you want to spook an NCAA person. Just say the word student athlete union. And
if you want to spook Pat Fitzgerald,
it was a dream for season.
If you say the word student athlete union within 100 miles of the Chicago area, Pat Fitzgerald busts into your door and tries a citizen's arrest on you.
Oh, man. So I think we've covered Indiana. We've covered Northwestern.
This is now a Big Ten podcast. Like, it just happened, and we have to honor, you know, the trajectory of that.
Hey, why stop there? We've covered LSU gymnastics. Cal got a shout out. West Virginia, Old Dominion, regular Virginia. Am I going to get in trouble for saying that? I'm Texas. Can you tell?
I don't know. I'd be not looking forward to that Marshall trip.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. You know, I hope we get there, and that this is what I have to live down. That
would, yeah, that would really, that's what we're worrying about. Some
semblance of football.
They're gonna get you.
Well, I did have a lot of fun. It was good to kind of get out of our Rice Bowl before all and just talk some big picture college football things. I think you might have been the first guest that's asked us a question, so this is good. You got us thinking on our feet, and we did pretty well, I think, for the off season.
No doubt, no doubt. Hey, I mean, at my heart, I'm a journalist, right? I gotta ask questions.
All right, well, thanks, Seth. Thanks so much for coming on, man. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, this is a lot of fun. I definitely have to have me back on.
When we get back to football.
Depending on how long this goes, we might have to have a lot of people back on. So.
We have more to talk about. There are so many rivalry trophies that we have not discussed.
Oh, I am happy to do the all rivalry trophies episode. Like, I could prepare a whole slideshow on weird rivalry trophies in college football. I'll power rank them. I don't care.
Just all of them. All of them.
Like, do people really want a Bayou bucket? If it's filled with crawfish, maybe?
I mean, I just love some of the manufactured ones that they've had to create to try to create new rivalries. Like, I mean, yeah, I'm sure.
Remember the civil conflict trophy?
The great,
because UCF sure didn't.
What's the Arkansas Missouri one? Do they have a name for it?
They do, I think, but I don't remember.
The trophy is just literally the two states on top of each other, and they change the border red or yellow versus who wins.
Well, that's the whole deal with the Bayou Bucket too. Is that it's Louisiana and Arkansas right on top of each other, isn't it?
That's the Golden Boot, the Arkansas LSU trophy. Yeah, no, it's just a giant gold statue of the two. It's one of those ones that's incredibly impractical because I think it weighs like 80 pounds or something like.
Wait, college football and incredibly impractical in the same sentence?
I know, what a surprise, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of them, man. And again, I definitely would not consider myself a Big Ten guy, but holy crap, do they have a market of that?
All right, well, go do your research, and when we get to trying to pull more content, you know, I tell people, folks are asking, I'm sure you've gotten this too, Shahan, but folks in media, like, well, what are you writing about right now? Like, how do you keep doing stuff? Like, I'm like, well, usually by the time we get to the end of June in a regular off season, I'm pulling at my hair saying, how am I going to possibly get through July and get to media days writing about something? So we've taken our 3 month off season and we've made it indefinite. So
yeah. Well, and I'll tell you what, I am in some ways lucky because we're actually right in the midst of magazine season. Like, I'm finishing up all the previews right now. Unfortunately, I don't get to do the Rice preview. That goes to the esteemed David Barron, but I am very, very much in the thick of things. So I'm just kind of looking forward actually to hitting my deadlines and getting to sit back for like 2 weeks before things pick back up again. But
that's where
yeah.
I'm at too. If I didn't have my preview to distract me, I'm it's good. We'll have more things coming, but yeah, I won't speak for Carter. I enjoyed having you on the podcast. I think Carter did as well. And we'll have to circle back at some point.
Definitely. Definitely. Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, thanks for those of you who stuck it out and listened to all of this. We'll see you for the next episode, and Rice Bite.
This show was edited and produced by Carter Spires. It features music from Joseph McDade.